Astori Publishing presents The Pulse of Capital. Dawn leaks over Main Street as the first delivery truck hisses to a halt outside Ellen Ramirez's corner bakery. Inside, the hum of refrigerators blends with the muted voice of a morning radio host announcing that interest rates have nudged upward again. Ellen's focus, however, is fixed on her register drawer. The cash that flowed in during yesterday's rush sits neatly banded, yet the bills that must flow out, rent, flour, wages, already crowd her thoughts. She does the silent arithmetic every owner knows by heart, weighing not profit in the accountant's sense, but the softer, faster pulse of cash itself. Whether the bakery's books end the month in black or red will hinge on that pulse. Three blocks away, Malik Johnson unlatches the garage door of his bicycle repair shop. December's holiday boom has left stacks of box derailleurs gleaming like promise and like risk. If he reinvests now in a laser-precise truing stand, spring cyclists might reward him handsomely. Yet the same purchase could leave him short of liquidity, the ready cash needed to answer tomorrow's unexpected expense. Liquidity, Malik reminds himself, differs from solvency. A solvent shop owns more than it owes in the long run, but solvency offers little comfort if the phone bill is due on Tuesday. Not every calculation this morning unfolds beneath a roof. On the riverfront promenade, Sofia Martinez pushes her chrome coffee cart into position, steam already curling skyward. A second cart would double her coverage, perhaps triple her revenues during festival season. The flyer in her pocket from an online lender promises approval in 24 hours at an interest rate that makes her wince. The risk-return trade-off is no abstraction here. Higher potential reward balanced against the chance of falling short and defaulting. Sofia inhales the scent of roasted beans, an aroma rich with both ambition and uncertainty. Across town, laundromat owner Luis Chen watches spinning cylinders of denim and cotton while scrolling through a flagged email. A supplier offers detergent at a 10% discount if he prepays a year in advance. Luis understands the time value of money in principle. A dollar paid today holds different worth from a dollar paid next year because today's dollar could be earning interest in the meantime. Yet theory turns slippery when stacked against real barrels of soap and the comfort of a well-padded emergency fund. Ellen, Malik, Sofia, and Luis may never meet, but their stories trace a single nationwide arc. In storefronts and workshops that line American streets, nearly half of the private workforce earns its paycheck. These enterprises, each with fewer than 500 employees, many with fewer than five, collectively generate close to half the nation's economic output. And yet, recent surveys reveal that only a minority of owners who apply for financing receive the full amount they request. Capital, once plentiful, now arrives more cautiously, demanding sharper strategies from those who seek it. The challenge is not merely securing funds. It is mastering the language of those funds, the grammar of cash flow, liquidity, and solvency, the syntax that links opportunity cost to risk and risk to expected return. Without fluency, a profitable on-paper bakery can still fail for lack of midnight cash, and a bike shop brimming with inventory can stall when suppliers tighten terms. External shocks. A pandemic, a rate hike, a supply chain snarl only amplify the stakes. This book opens on that uneasy threshold where passion meets arithmetic. It follows proprietors like Ellen and Malik, distilling the analytical tools that bankers frame in spreadsheets, yet owners must wield on the fly. Present value that discounts tomorrow's dollars into today's, weighted average cost of capital that reveals the real price of money, and net present value that declares whether an idea adds or erodes wealth. These concepts will surface not as lecture hall abstractions, but as living companions to pre-dawn dough kneading, mid-season inventory counts, and late-night ledger reviews. And still, a larger question hangs in the air with the scent of rising yeast. Can small enterprises thrive when capital tightens and markets shift, not through luck, but through disciplined financial insight? The answer, whispered in the rustle of receipts and the click of bike chains, beckons from the chapters ahead. Outside Ellen's shop, The sun finally clears the rooftops, catching the pale mist above Sophia's espresso machine and glinting off Malik's storefront glass. Luis taps his phone, hesitates, and holds his decision for one more cycle of the dryers. In that shared pause, brief, deliberate, charged with possibility, lies the story of every owner who has ever balanced a ledger against a dream. End of prologue. Small businesses are the lifeblood of any economy, and the United States is no exception. According to the U.S. Small Business Administration, firms with fewer than 500 employees contribute roughly 44% of U.S. GDP and 46% of private sector employment. The financial health of these enterprises, therefore, is not just a concern for individual owners, but a matter of national importance. In a landscape where capital is the engine of growth, access to financing is crucial. Yet, according to the Federal Reserve's 2023 Small Business Credit Survey, only 2 out of every 5 applicants were approved for the full amount of financing they requested, a sharp decline from pre-pandemic norms. This makes a solid understanding of small business finance not just prudent, but essential, for it equips owners with the acumen to manage internal finances effectively, even when external funding is scarce. So, what exactly do we mean by small business finance? It refers to the management of money and other assets to enable a business to operate successfully. This involves a range of activities from budgeting and forecasting to investing and borrowing. 3 foundational concepts underpin this field: cash flow, liquidity, and solvency. Let's define each. Cash flow is essentially the movement of money in and out of your business. It's the lifeblood that keeps the doors open and the lights on. There's a vital distinction to be made here between accounting profit and actual cash. A business can be profitable on paper, yet cash poor if customers are slow to pay or if too much stock is tied up in inventory. That's why managing cash flow is paramount. Liquidity, our second term, refers to how quickly you can convert assets into cash. It's a measure of your business's ability to meet short-term obligations. A liquor store with well-stocked shelves may be rich in inventory, but may struggle to pay its employees if that inventory doesn't convert back into cash quickly enough, that is, if it lacks liquidity. Solvency, the third concept, refers to a business's ability to meet its long-term financial obligations. While liquidity is about the short term, solvency is the long game, a measure of whether your assets outweigh your liabilities. A solvent business is one that can withstand the ebbs and flows of changing economic tides without going under. Consider the corner bakery that wrestles with separating personal and commercial bank accounts, or the bicycle repair shop debating whether its holiday profits should be reinvested in new equipment or held as cash reserves for the winter lull. These are the real-world financial pressures that mom-and-pop operators know all too well. There is an emotional valence to each decision, an undercurrent of personal investment that can never be fully divorced from the balance sheet. Such decisions only grow more complex when we consider that the value of money itself is not static. In finance, we understand that a dollar today is worth more than a dollar tomorrow. Why? Because money in hand today can be invested to generate returns. This fundamental principle, known as the time value of money, will be our bridge from these foundational concepts to more sophisticated analytical tools in the chapters ahead. With this shared vocabulary in place, we now turn our attention to this pivotal concept, the time value of money. By applying its logic, we'll begin to see not just individual financial decisions, but the entire enterprise of small business finance with fresh eyes, marking the worth of each dollar bill, each account receivable, and each inventory item is a vital first step in ensuring that our small businesses remain vibrant contributors to the economy. Understanding these core definitions and principles is crucial for navigating the financial landscape of any small business. As we move forward, we'll explore these concepts in greater detail, always with an eye toward how they apply to the daily realities and pressures faced by small business owners. The concept of the time value of money is foundational to making sound financial decisions in both personal and business contexts. Simply put, a dollar today is worth more than a dollar received in the future. This principle underlies many of the financial decisions that small business owners face on a daily basis. Let's consider two everyday examples to illustrate this concept. First, imagine a small laundromat owner who is offered a lump sum of $5,000 today, or the same amount spread out over 3 years through a customer loyalty card program. How does the owner decide which option to choose? The answer lies in understanding present value and future value formulas, which allow us to compare amounts of money received at different points in time. The future value formula calculates what an investment made today will be worth in the future given an assumed interest rate, while the present value formula does the opposite. It calculates the value today of a sum of money to be received in the future. The present value formula can be expressed as PV equals FV SWT 1 plus R SWT N, where PV is the present value, FV is the future value, R is the discount rate or interest rate, and N is the number of periods, usually years. Returning to our laundromat owner, let's assume that he could invest the $5,000 today at a 5% annual interest rate. The future value of that sum in 3 years would be FV equal 5,000 times 1 plus 0.53, 5,788.3 T. In contrast, if the owner were to receive the same $5,000 over 3 years, the present value of those payments would need to be calculated using the present value formula. PV equals 5,000, 1 plus 4,329.34. In this case, the laundromat owner would be better off taking the lump sum today and investing it at 5%, as the future value of that investment, 5,788.13, is greater than the present value of the future cash flows, 4,329.34. A second example involves a bulk purchase. Consider a small business that is offered the opportunity to prepay for a year's worth of supplies at a 10% discount. Should the owner take the discount and pay up front, or hold on to the cash and pay monthly? Assuming that the business could invest its cash at a 3% annual interest rate, the owner can calculate the present value of the foregone discount to determine if it is worth prepaying. If the supplies would normally cost $5,000 per year, the 10% discount would be worth $500. Using the present value formula, PV equals 500, FIT 1 plus 03, 485.44. In this case, the present value of the foregone discount, 485.44, is less than the actual value of the discount, 500, suggesting that the owner should take the discount and prepay for the supplies, assuming there are no other liquidity constraints. These examples demonstrate the importance of understanding the time value of money in making sound financial decisions. By calculating the present and future values of different options, business owners can determine which option is most financially advantageous. But the time value of money is not the only consideration when making financial decisions. In the next section, we'll explore another important concept, the opportunity cost of foregone alternatives. Understanding the time value of money, as we've just discussed, is crucial for making sound financial decisions. However, there's another critical factor that often goes unnoticed in the decision-making process, and that is the opportunity cost. Opportunity cost represents the potential benefits an individual, investor, or business misses out on when choosing one alternative over another. It's the road not taken, the foregone option that could have been pursued instead of the one selected. The concept of opportunity cost has its roots in classical economics, tracing back to early economists like Johann Heinrich von Thunen in the 19th century. Von Thunen first noticed that the cost of producing a good could be measured not just in monetary terms, but also in terms of the alternatives foregone to produce that good. This became a foundational principle in modern economics, including small business finance. In the world of small businesses, Understanding and valuing your time and resources in terms of opportunity cost can greatly impact the financial health of your business. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics provides us with benchmarks for valuing owner time, often using the median wage of a manager in a comparable industry. For example, if the median wage for a restaurant manager is $20 per hour, then every hour a small business owner spends on tasks that could be delegated or automated represents a $20 opportunity cost. Let's look at two real-world examples to illustrate the principle of opportunity cost. First, consider the case of a small business owner who has to decide whether to attend an industry expo or stay at the store to manage operations. Attending the expo incurs travel expenses and results in downtime for the store, which could mean lost sales. On the other hand, the expo offers opportunities for networking, learning about new products, and possibly finding better suppliers, which could lead to cost savings or increased future sales. If the owner decides to stay at the store, the foregone benefits of the expo represent the opportunity cost of that decision. Another example might be a small business owner considering whether to keep a $10,000 emergency cash buffer or to use that money to take advantage of a supplier's 3% early payment discount. Keeping the cash means increased liquidity and a safety net for unexpected expenses. However, using the cash for the discount could mean significant cost savings over the long term. Here, the opportunity cost of keeping the cash is the foregone savings from the discount. In each case, calculating the opportunity cost involves comparing the expected benefits of each option and determining which offers the most value. This is not always a straightforward process, and it often involves making judgments based on incomplete information. However, by acknowledging and attempting to quantify these costs, small business owners can make more informed decisions that contribute to the overall financial health of their businesses. The concept of opportunity cost reminds us that every decision made in business involves a trade-off. By recognizing these trade-offs and considering their potential impacts, small business owners can better navigate the complex landscape of small business finance. In the following sections, we'll dive deeper into more sophisticated analytical tools and strategies that can help small businesses thrive. Understanding opportunity costs requires us to think broadly about the implications of our decisions. It's not just about the money currently in your cash register or bank account. It's about the money that could be there if you had made different choices. With this in mind, we are ready to explore the next concept, the risk-return trade-off. Understanding the risk-return trade-off is essential for any small business owner looking to make smart financial decisions. At its core, this principle illustrates that potential return rises with risk. It's a fundamental concept in finance, encapsulated in the old adage, "Nothing ventured, nothing gained." In essence, if you want higher returns, you have to be willing to take on more risk. But what does this mean in practical terms, and how can we quantify it? Let's delve into some concrete examples and data to get a better understanding. If we look at historical data, we see that over the long term, the S&P 500, an index of 500 large U.S. companies, has delivered annual returns of nearly 10%. In contrast, the yields on 10-year U.S. Treasury bonds have been significantly lower, typically hovering between 3 and 4%. The difference between these two rates is known as the equity risk premium, the extra return that investors demand for taking on the additional risk of stocks compared to risk-free government bonds. Now let's consider the risk side. PayNet's Small Business Default Index, which measures the percentage of loans in default, averaged 2.8% during 2022-23. This tells us that lending to small businesses carries a certain level of risk, specifically a 2.8% chance that the borrower will fail to repay the loan in a given year. With these numbers in mind, let's explore how this trade-off plays out in real-world scenarios. Imagine a coffee cart owner who is deciding whether to invest in a certificate of deposit offering a 2% annual return or to finance a second cart with an 8% interest loan. The CD is safe, the return is guaranteed, but it's also low. On the other hand, the second cart could potentially generate higher returns, but it comes with risks. It might not be as profitable as the first cart, and there's a chance it could fail entirely. Similarly, a seasonal fireworks stand might have to decide between continuing to source its products from a local vendor at predictable margins or switching to an online wholesaler offering lower prices but carrying the risk of delayed shipments and quality issues. In each case, the business owner must weigh the potential returns against the risk and determine whether the risk is worth it. Calculating the risk-return trade-off involves comparing the expected returns of each option and considering the probability and potential impact of adverse outcomes. It's not an exact science, as it requires making judgments about future events that are inherently uncertain. However, by acknowledging these risks and attempting to quantify them, small business owners can make more informed decisions that strike the right balance between risk and potential reward. In the examples we looked at, the coffee cart owner might decide that the potential return from a second cart outweighs the risk of the loan. The fireworks stand, on the other hand, might decide that the reliability of the local vendor is worth the higher cost. There's no universally correct answer. It depends on the specific circumstances and risk tolerance of each business. Understanding the risk-return trade-off doesn't eliminate uncertainty in decision-making, but it does provide a framework for evaluating the potential rewards and risks of different options. By considering these trade-offs carefully, small business owners can navigate the inherent risks of their business more effectively and make decisions that contribute to their long-term financial success. With this understanding of risk and reward, we are now ready to explore the concept of the cost of capital. At its most basic, the cost of capital represents the price of obtaining funds to finance a business. Whether the money comes from taking out a loan, selling stock to investors, or reinvesting profits, there is always a cost involved. The cost of capital is composed of two main elements, the cost of debt and the cost of equity. The cost of debt is relatively straightforward. It is the interest rate a business pays on its loans or bonds. This cost is explicit and easy to quantify. For example, if a small business takes out a loan with a 7% annual interest rate, its cost of debt is 7%. The cost of equity, on the other hand, is more complex. It represents the return that investors expect to earn on their investment in the company. This return is a function of the risk involved. The higher the risk, the higher the return investors will demand. Unlike the cost of debt, the cost of equity is implicit and must be estimated. To calculate the cost of equity, many financial professionals use the Capital Asset Pricing Model, or CAPM. We'll dive into the specifics of CAPM in a later section, but for now, it's enough to understand that the cost of equity is typically higher than the cost of debt, reflecting the greater risk taken on by investors. Armed with these two costs, we can now calculate the weighted average cost of capital, or WACC. The WACC represents the average cost of all the money that has been invested in a business, weighted by the proportion of each type of financing. The formula is WACC equals cost of equity times proportion of equity, plus cost of debt times proportion of debt, times 1 minus corporate tax rate. The WACC is a crucial benchmark for making financial decisions in a small business. It represents the minimum return that a business must earn on its investments in order to satisfy the claims of both debt and equity investors. If a business can't generate a return higher than its WACC, it will destroy value over the long run. Consider the example of a small family-owned print shop. Suppose the business has $150,000 in debt at a 7% interest rate and $250,000 in equity. The owner requires a minimum return of 12% on her equity investment. Assuming a corporate tax rate of 21%, we can calculate the WACC CC as follows. WACC C equals 12% times 250,000, 400,000, plus 7% times 150,000, 400, times 1 minus 0.21, 9.04 cents. This means that the print shop must earn an average return of at least 9.04% on its investments to meet the expectations of both its debt and equity investors. By understanding the cost of capital, small business owners can set a clear benchmark for evaluating the attractiveness of different investments and financing options. In the following sections, we'll delve into more detail on how to calculate and use the WACC in practice, as well as explore other key concepts like the capital asset pricing model and the valuation of perpetuities. Now that we understand the importance of the weighted average cost of capital, let's dive into the practical details of calculating WACC for a small business. To illustrate this, we will walk through a real-world example of a sample firm, Crunchy Munchies, Inc. Crunchy Munchies is a small snacks manufacturer with the following capital structure. It has $150,000 in debt, on which it pays an interest rate of 6% per annum. The firm's equity is valued at $250,000. The combined value of the firm's debt and equity is therefore $400,000. Now, let's assume that the business owner requires a minimum return of 12% on equity investment, and the corporate tax rate stands at 21%. Let's break down the WACC calculation into a few simple steps. Step 1. Determine the proportion of each financing source. Debt proportion equals 150,000.375 or 37.5%. Equity proportion equals 250,000 player, 400.625 or 62.5%. Step 2. Calculate the cost of debt. After-tax cost of debt equals 6% equals 4.74%. Step 3. Calculate the cost of equity. Cost of equity equals 12%. Step 4. Calculate the weighted average cost of capital. WACC 0.375 4.74 cents plus 0.625 12t equals 9.53 cents. This means that Crunchy Munchies Inc.'s weighted average cost of capital is 9.53%. Reminder, pause for calculation. Understanding and calculating the WACC C is essential for any small business. It provides the minimum return that a company must earn on its investments in order to satisfy the claims of both debt and equity investors. If a business consistently earns less than its WACC C, it will struggle to grow and may eventually fail. Now, take a moment and perform the calculations yourself using the figures for Crunchy Munchies Inc., or, even better, substituting these with figures from your own business. This exercise will not only give you hands-on practice in calculating WACC C, but will also help you understand your business's capital structure better. Understanding your WACC can guide your decisions on financing and investing activities, helping you maintain a healthy financial trajectory for your business. With our weighted average cost of capital calculated, we now turn our attention to estimating the cost of equity for small, privately held firms. One of the most widely used models for determining the cost of equity is the Capital Asset Pricing Model, or CAPM. CAPM provides a framework for thinking about the relationship between risk and expected return, and it has been a staple of finance theory since its development in the 1960s. The CAPM formula is cost of equity equals risk-free rate plus beta times market return minus risk-free rate. The risk-free rate represents the return an investor can earn on an investment with no risk. For practical purposes, we often use the yield on the 10-year U.S. Treasury bond, which was approximately 3.6% in mid-2023. The market return is the expected return on a broad stock market index, such as the S&P 500. Historically, the S&P 500 has returned about 10% per year over long periods. The difference between the market return and the risk-free rate is known as the market risk premium, the additional return investors expect for taking on the risk of investing in stocks. Beta is a measure of how a particular stock's returns are expected to move relative to the overall market. A beta of 1 means the stock is expected to move in lockstep with the market. A beta greater than 1 indicates the stock is riskier than the market, while a beta less than 1 indicates it's less risky. For example, if a stock has a beta of 1.2 and the market risk premium is 6%, based on a market return of 10% and a risk-free rate of 3.6%, the expected return on the stock would be cost of equity equals 3.6% plus 1.2 times 10% is 3.6%. For small, privately held firms, estimating beta can be tricky, as these companies are not publicly traded. One approach is to identify a group of publicly traded firms that are similar to the target firm in terms of industry, size, and operating characteristics, and use the average beta of these comparable firms as an estimate of the target firm's beta. This estimated beta can then be adjusted to reflect the specific capital structure of the target firm. The idea is to calculate what's known as the unlevered beta for the comparable firms, that is, the beta that reflects only the business risk of the firms, not the financial risk that comes from their particular mix of debt and equity financing. The unlevered beta can then be relevered to reflect the actual capital structure of the target firm. Suppose we're trying to estimate the cost of equity for a small, privately held pharmacy. We've identified a set of comparable publicly traded firms with an average beta of 0.8. We unlever this beta to remove the effect of the comparable firm's debt financing, then relever it to reflect the pharmacy's own capital structure. The result is an estimate of what the pharmacy's beta would be if it were publicly traded. With this adjusted beta in hand, we can now calculate the cost of equity for the pharmacy using the CAPM formula. If the risk-free rate is 3.6% and the market risk premium is 6%, the pharmacy's cost of equity would be cost of equity equals 3.6% plus 0.8 times 6%, 8.4%. This cost of equity estimate can then be used as part of the weighted average cost of capital calculation we discussed earlier. By incorporating the cost of equity from CAPM into its WebEAC, the pharmacy and indeed any small business can gain a more nuanced understanding of its true cost of capital and make more informed decisions about investments and financing. Remember, CAPM is not a perfect model, and estimating beta for private firms involves some inherent uncertainties. Nevertheless, CAPM remains a useful tool for thinking about the cost of equity for small businesses. The key is to keep your assumptions reasonable, your data current, and your calculations transparent. With this approach, CAPM can be an invaluable addition to your financial toolkit. In the world of finance, the concept of the time value of money tells us that a dollar today is worth more than a dollar in the future. This principle is crucial when evaluating investments or assessing the viability of business ventures. It brings us to an essential tool in financial decision-making, net present value, or NPV. The NPV is a central concept in finance that helps us understand whether an investment will add value. Let's consider an example to illustrate this concept. Imagine you own a small pet grooming salon and want to expand your services by purchasing a mobile grooming van for $12,000. Before making this investment, you forecast the after-tax cash inflows the van will generate over the next 3 years to be $5,000 per year. The question is, does this investment make financial sense? To answer that, we need to calculate the NPV of the investment. NPV converts future cash flows into today's dollars, considering the time value of money. It utilizes a discount rate, usually the weighted average cost of capital that we calculated earlier, to perform this conversion. Let's assume that the WCC for your pet grooming business is 9.04%, as calculated previously. We will use this rate to discount the future cash inflows back to their present values. The present value of the first year's cash inflow of $5,000 would be 5,000 SWEF 1 plus 00904, 4,587. The second year's inflow would be worth 5,004, 1 plus 0.904, equals 4,204 11 in today's dollars, and the third year's inflow would be worth 5,000, 43, 3,853.57. To find the total present value of these future cash flows, we add them up, 4,587.36, plus 4,204.1, plus 12,645.04. However, to determine the NPV, we must also consider the initial cost of the investment. Subtracting the initial investment from the total present value of future cash inflows gives us NPV equals 12,645.04 minus 12,000 equals 645.04. Since the NPV is positive, it indicates that the investment in the grooming van is expected to generate a return greater than the cost of capital, and hence should be undertaken. This simple example demonstrates the power of NPV in decision-making. It provides a clear accept or reject signal based on whether the NPV is positive or negative. It's a powerful tool that can guide small business owners in making informed, financially sound decisions. The concept of net present value is a powerful one, providing a clear signal of whether an investment should be accepted or rejected. However, it is not the only tool that small business owners have at their disposal. Another metric that many find useful is the internal rate of return, or IRR. The internal rate of return is the discount rate at which the net present value of an investment equals zero. Simplified, it's the rate of growth that an investment is expected to generate. If the IRR is higher than the cost of capital, then the investment is considered good. It will deliver more value than it costs. Consider a situation where a small business owner is considering expanding her food truck business. She estimates the initial investment would be $20,000 for a new truck. This expansion is projected to bring in additional cash inflows of $7,000, $8,000, and $9,000 over the next 3 years, respectively. To find the IRR, she would need to determine the discount rate that makes the present value of these cash inflows equal to the initial investment of $20,000. This calculation is typically done using financial calculators or spreadsheet software. Let's say the calculated IRR turns out to be 18%. This means that the investment in the new truck is expected to generate an 18% annual return. To know if this is attractive, she must compare this IRR to her business's cost of capital. If her weighted average cost of capital is 9.53%, then the IRR of 18% is certainly compelling, indicating that the investment could be a wise decision. However, while the IRR is a useful tool, it is not without its issues. One key problem can arise when investments have unconventional cash flow patterns. In such cases, there might be more than one IRR, which can complicate the decision-making process. Consider an alternative project where the business owner receives a $5,000 grant upfront in addition to the $20,000 initial investment. The cash inflows from this project are projected to be $10,000 for each of the next 3 years. In this case, there might be two different IRRs that make the NPV zero, which can lead to confusion. In such circumstances, it is often advisable to rely more on the net present value than on the internal rate of return, as NPV always provides a unique and clear decision signal. Despite its shortcomings, the IRR remains a widely used tool in financial decision-making due to its intuitively appealing interpretation as an effective interest rate earned on an investment. Small business owners should use it judiciously, in conjunction with net present value and a thorough understanding of the investment's cash flow patterns. We have explored various instruments in our financial toolkit, such as the internal rate of return and net present value, which help evaluate projects with defined end dates. However, not all business opportunities fit neatly into this mold. Some investments promise to generate income indefinitely. Think of a property lease that collects rent year after year, or franchise fees that keep trickling in perpetually. How do we value such endless income streams? This brings us to the concept of perpetuity valuation. A perpetuity is an annuity in which the periodic payments begin on a fixed date and continue indefinitely. To value a perpetuity, we use the Gordon growth model for valuing ongoing cash flows. The formula for a zero growth perpetuity is simple. You divide the cash flow by the discount rate. For a growing perpetuity, you divide next year's cash flow by the discount rate minus the growth rate. Let's voice these formulas twice for better retention. For a zero growth perpetuity, the formula is present value equals cash flow divided by discount rate. For a growing perpetuity, the formula is present value equals next year's cash flow divided by the discount rate minus the growth rate. One crucial point to remember is that the discount rate must exceed the growth rate, otherwise the equation will give an infinite valuation, which is not practical. Let's apply this to real-world examples. Consider a small self-storage facility generating $15,000 of annual net cash. If we assume a discount rate of 9%, we can calculate its present value using the zero growth perpetuity formula. Present value, 15,000, 0.09, 166,666.67. Next, consider a subscription-based software service that expects its cash flows to grow at 2% annually. If the discount rate is 9%, we can calculate its present value using the growing perpetuity formula. Present value equals 15,000, cores 0.09.202 equals 240,285.71. These calculations are only as accurate as the assumptions underlying them. The discount rate should reflect the risk associated with the cash flows, and the growth rate should be sustainable in the long run. With these tools at your disposal, you can now evaluate and compare different investment alternatives, whether they have a defined endpoint or promise an endless income stream. This ability can help you make informed financial decisions and guide your business toward long-term success. Now that we have a thorough understanding of various analytical techniques for evaluating different types of investments, we can synthesize these instruments into a cohesive decision-making framework. Integrating metrics like net present value, internal rate of return, and related diagnostics can provide a disciplined and comprehensive approach to capital budgeting, tailored for the independent owner. Let's consider the case of a local deli owner who is evaluating three different investment opportunities: purchasing a new delivery van, launching a social media advertising campaign, and remodeling the deli's interior. Each project has its own set of cash flows and associated risks. To rank these projects effectively, the deli owner begins by calculating the NPV of each initiative, projecting the cash inflows and outflows for each project, and discounting them back to their present values using the business's WACC. Assuming the deli's WACC is 9.53%, the owner computes the NPV for each investment option. The delivery van, costing $15,000 upfront, is expected to generate additional cash flows of $6,000 per year for the next 5 years. The social media campaign requires an initial investment of $5,000 and is expected to increase annual revenues by $4,000 for the next 3 years. The interior remodeling project carries an upfront cost of $10,000 and is anticipated to boost annual sales by $3,000 indefinitely. After calculating the NPV for each project, the deli owner ranks them accordingly, with the highest NPV project being the most financially attractive. If two projects have similar NPVs, the owner then examines the IRR of each project to break the tie, preferring the project with the higher IRR, provided it exceeds the business's WACC. Once the projects are ranked, the deli owner conducts a sensitivity analysis on the top-ranked project. This involves varying the discount rate by plus or minus 2 percentage points to test how sensitive the project's NPV is to changes in the cost of capital. The result of this analysis reveals how robust the investment decision is, given potential fluctuations in the cost of capital. Suppose the delivery van purchase emerges as the top-ranked project based on its NPV. The owner then tests the sensitivity of its NPV by recalculating it using discount rates of 7.53% and 11.53%. If the NPV remains positive under these varied rates, the project is considered robust and a sound investment. Conversely, if the NPV becomes negative when the discount rate is adjusted, the project may be too risky, warranting a reassessment. This disciplined evaluation protocol ensures that the deli owner's investment decision is grounded in sound financial analysis rather than intuition or impulse. By using a combination of NPV, IRR, and sensitivity analysis, the owner can confidently prioritize the delivery van purchase over other potential investments, knowing that it offers the strongest financial return for the business. This capital budgeting framework, integrating various financial metrics and diagnostics, can be applied to any small business facing a range of investment opportunities. By following this systematic approach, independent business owners can make informed financial decisions and guide their businesses toward long-term success. With this toolkit at their disposal, small business owners are now equipped to navigate the financing options and strategies for funding these investments. Understanding how to evaluate investment opportunities is only the first step in growing a small business. Once a promising project has been identified, owners face a second critical task: financing that investment. The landscape of financing choices for small businesses can be as varied and nuanced as the ventures themselves. By understanding the different sources of funding available, as well as the strategies for accessing them, owners can make smart decisions about how to fund their growth. Let's begin with the most traditional avenue, bank loans. Small businesses often turn to loans for funding, whether it's a term loan, a line of credit, or a business credit card. The terms and conditions of these loans vary, but most require a solid credit history, collateral, and a detailed business plan. According to the Federal Reserve, as of 2023, the average interest rate on a Small Business Administration 7A loan, a common choice for many small businesses, was prime plus 2.75%. While bank loans are a reliable source of funding, they can also be difficult for very small or new businesses to secure. In recent years, alternative online lenders have emerged to fill this gap. These lenders offer faster, more flexible financing options, often with less stringent requirements. Their approval rates are higher, but this accessibility comes at a cost. According to the Federal Reserve, the average interest rate for these alternative loans can be significantly higher than traditional bank loans. For a small business owner, this trade-off must be carefully evaluated. Another key source of funding is supplier trade credit. This is essentially an informal loan from a supplier, allowing the business to defer payment on goods and services purchased. Terms such as 2 to 10 net 30 are common, meaning that the business gets a 2% discount on the total invoice if paid within 10 days, or else the full amount is due in 30 days. While trade credit can be a useful tool, particularly for managing cash flow, it's important to remember that failing to take the discount is effectively a form of short-term financing with an implicit cost that can be high when annualized. Two case studies illustrate these principles in action. First, consider a local florist who needed to increase inventory ahead of a peak holiday season. Unable to secure a traditional bank loan quickly enough, she turned to an alternative online lender. The interest rate was high, but the fast approval process allowed her to seize a time-sensitive opportunity. On the other hand, a tire shop owner relies on supplier trade credit to manage his cash flow during seasonal peaks. By carefully timing his purchases and payments, he's able to use this credit as a form of short-term financing without taking on additional debt. In both cases, the owners made strategic decisions about financing based on the needs and circumstances of their businesses. This is the heart of institutional strategy, aligning the form and cost of financing with the business's ability to bear that cost and put the funds to good use. Remember, every dollar of financing has a cost, whether it's the interest on a loan or the implicit cost of trade credit. This cost must be balanced against the potential return of the investment it's funding. That is why understanding the cost of capital, discussed in previous sections, is so crucial. It provides the benchmark against which all financing decisions should be measured. Ultimately, choosing how to finance a small business comes down to balancing cost, risk, and accessibility. By understanding the full range of financing options available and the costs and benefits of each, small business owners can craft a strategy that allows them to fund growth while preserving the health and sustainability of their businesses. Understanding the various financing options and strategies is crucial for small businesses aiming to grow and thrive. However, the landscape of small business finance is not static. It is marked by ongoing debates, potential pitfalls, and emerging trends that every business owner must navigate. By staying informed about these elements, owners can make better decisions that align with their business goals and values. One of the most significant debates in small business finance today revolves around the question of self-financing, or bootstrapping, versus seeking external funding. Proponents of bootstrapping argue that it allows businesses to maintain control and avoid the pressures of debt or equity partnerships. However, data from the Kauffman Foundation suggests a more nuanced picture. According to their research, businesses that engage in early equity partnerships have higher survival rates, indicating that while bootstrapping has its advantages, external funding can provide the capital necessary for growth and resilience. In terms of emerging trends, one noteworthy development is the rise of community development financial institutions, or CDFIs. These institutions are dedicated to providing affordable, responsible financing to underserved communities and businesses. In 2022, CDFIs expanded their microloan volumes by 8% year over year, signaling a growing recognition of the importance of supporting small businesses in these areas. Another trend gaining traction is the incorporation of environmental, social, and governance criteria, known as ESG, into lending decisions. This reflects a broader societal shift towards sustainability and social responsibility. For small businesses, this trend presents both challenges and opportunities. On one hand, businesses may need to adapt their practices to meet these criteria. On the other hand, those that successfully do so may be able to access new sources of funding and attract socially conscious customers. Yet, while these debates and trends offer potential avenues for growth, they also come with pitfalls. One common mistake is over-reliance on simple metrics, such as payback periods, which ignore the time value of money. For instance, a hardware store owner might misjudge the return on investment for a new forklift by overlooking the cost of tying up capital in inventory. Another pitfall is failing to consider the full tax implications of financial decisions. For example, a cleaning service might underestimate the impact of Paycheck Protection Program loan forgiveness on its tax liability, leading to unexpected costs down the line. To avoid these pitfalls, small business owners must arm themselves with a solid understanding of financial principles and stay abreast of changes in the financial landscape. They must also be rigorous in their analysis, considering all relevant factors and potential outcomes before making decisions. Moving forward, there are several watch points that small businesses should keep in mind. Shifts in policy by the Federal Open Market Committee can directly affect discount rates, which in turn influence the cost of capital and investment decisions. Similarly, changes in tax law can impact the relative attractiveness of different financing options. By monitoring these and other indicators, small businesses can adapt their strategies and continue to make sound financial decisions. By understanding the debates, recognizing the trends, avoiding the pitfalls, and monitoring the watch points in small business finance, owners can craft strategies that allow them to fuel growth while preserving the health and sustainability of their businesses. As we reach the conclusion of our journey through the complexities of small business finance, it is essential to summarize the core insights, create actionable checklists, and point toward future developments that need monitoring. Our voyage has equipped us with powerful concepts like the time value of money, opportunity cost, and the weighted average cost of capital. These ideas are not mere academic theories, but practical tools that can significantly enhance the financial health of a small business. So, how does a small business owner translate these concepts into action? Let's craft a checklist that synthesizes the key principles we've covered. 1. Understand your costs. Keep a vigilant eye on all your costs, both explicit, like rent and salaries, and implicit, like the cost of equity. Remember that understanding the cost of capital can help you set benchmarks for evaluating investments and financing. 2. Apply the time value principle. Always consider the time value of money when making financial decisions. Whether you're investing in new equipment or offering a discount for early payments, remember that money today is worth more than money tomorrow. 3. Calculate and use ECC. Regularly calculate your weighted average cost of capital and use it as your benchmark for making investment decisions. This helps ensure that any investments you make generate returns that exceed your cost of capital. 4. Understand the risk-return trade-off. Be mindful of the risk-return trade-off in your decision-making. Higher returns usually come with higher risks. Assess your risk tolerance and evaluate potential investments and financing options accordingly. 5. Use net present value and internal rate of return. Utilize both NPV and IRR when evaluating the viability of long-term projects. Remember that while NPV gives you a dollar amount, IRR provides a percentage that can be easily compared across different investments. 6. Be aware of perpetuities. If you have any investments or income streams that promise to continue indefinitely, use the perpetuity valuation formula to estimate their present value. 7. Choose the right financing. Whether bank loans, supplier credit, or online lenders, select the financing option that best aligns with your business's needs and risk profile. Remember that each financing source alters your firm's overall cost of capital. Stay abreast of trends and pitfalls. Keep yourself informed about ongoing debates, common pitfalls, and emerging trends in small business finance. This knowledge can help you avoid costly mistakes and seize new opportunities. 9. Monitor your decisions. Continuously monitor the outcomes of your financial decisions. Learn from both successes and failures, and adapt your strategies accordingly. While this actionable checklist provides a solid foundation, it is equally important to identify verifiable watchpoints to keep your small business on a successful financial path. Key indicators to monitor include shifts in Federal Open Market Committee policy, changes in tax laws, and trends in ESG lending criteria. Notably, changes in Federal Open Market Committee policy can directly alter discount rates, thereby influencing the cost of capital and investment decisions. Furthermore, shifts in tax laws can impact the relative attractiveness of different financing options. As we revisit our earlier examples, the corner bakery, the auto repair garage, and the local deli, we see how an integrated financial framework can inform both immediate and future decisions. By applying these proven tools with a vigilant eye on changing conditions, you can guide your business with clarity, courage, and rigorous financial insight. Thank you for choosing Astori Publishing.